Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, December 2nd, 2011. Happy December, everyone. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Tara Gardner and Alyssa Ray. And actually, Tara's not here yet. Oh, Tara is here. She just arrived. Thanks for coming, Tara. Our control room tech trainee, Morgan Ahoff, is here too. Animal Voices is Vancouver's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan-related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage the movement toward a world in which animals are treated with compassion and mercy and are afforded the same rights that humans take for granted. This program can be heard every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at coopradio.org and available as podcasts on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. On today's show, we'll be speaking with local Vancouver animal activist and Food Not Bombs volunteer Maya Mayhem for our first interview. She'll be telling us about her experiences nourishing the spirits and bellies of the 99% at the Occupy Vancouver Tent City. Throughout the five-week-long encampment of the Occupy Vancouver movement, local Food Not Bombs volunteers worked hard to serve up free vegetarian food for all while spreading their message of nonviolent resistance. Maya will shed light on how the organization Food Not Bombs works to raise awareness about animal exploitation and will share her insights on why animal activists should join their voices with the Occupy movement. And for our feature interview today, we have Danielle Thompson on the show. She is the executive director of the fairly newly formed nonprofit organization based in the States called the Galapagos Preservation Society, which strives to protect the indigenous wildlife and unique ecosystems of the Galapagos Islands. And with that, also works on improving the welfare of the thousands of stray domesticated dogs and cats that freely roam the island. I first met Danielle last year at an animal rights conference and have been wanting to have her on the show since, so this is perfect timing as she is planning a trip to the Galapagos with the organization next month in January with the intention of spaying and neutering dogs and cats there, as well as providing education to the public on responsible companion animal ownership. That interview is coming up in about 32 minutes, so please stay tuned for that. Alyssa, you went to see a documentary film last night called The Whale, which is currently playing here in Vancouver. And just so you know, I can't hear you right now, but to tell us about that. Go ahead.
I would like to tell you about that. It's actually not playing now. I saw the last showing last night. I'm really, really glad I did. It's a movie called The Whale, and it's about the story of Luna, a young and spunky, lonely orca who lived off the west coast of Vancouver Island near Gold River in Nootka Sound. Now, of course, orcas are familial-based creatures that live in big pods with their whole families. But Luna somehow lost his pod, which was 320 kilometers away. And he tried his best, basically, to create a makeshift pod, because they're very social creatures, out of those he met and bonded with, the humans and the humans on the boats around the sound. He was just two when he was first noticed in Nootka Sound, and he lived in the sound for 4 years until he was six. So he was a young guy. Orcas, for those of us who don't know, live about 60 years. The film, which is narrated by locally raised actor Ryan Reynolds, traced the story of Luna and all the hearts he touched along the way, as well as the controversy his presence stirred up. Most of all, the people who were blessed to meet Luna and gaze into his eyes would say that he just needed the companionship humans offered. The crux of the conflict, though, was between the locals, those who had a personal connection with Luna, and the officials, the Department of Fisheries, who mandated that human contact with the whale must be halted because it was deemed unnatural interference. And they thought maybe that it would lead to trauma for him and lead to his death because whales, it's shown that the more contact they have with humans, the more likely they are to die young deaths. So that was the main controversy, and they thought that they were acting in the best interest of Luna, but everyone who met him really felt that he just needed friends. And eventually, even the stewards themselves, who were hired by the Department of Fisheries to dissuade people from contacting Luna and, you know, basically petting him and being friends with him, they became friends with him as well. So no one was immune to the big heart and playful spirit of Luna, and he was just completely charming. And yeah, that's basically the gist of the story.
This is a heartbreaking story to me. I remember this story. And when did it happen exactly? We were talking about this. You said this film was originally made in 2008. It seems like it was more recent to that, because it was right here in our backyard, just near Vancouver.
Yeah, I'm guessing it must have been 2007, because I'm guessing, but that's an estimate.
Anyways, I do remember this story. I remember hearing stories about Luna, and then Luna tragically died because he got hit by a large boat, actually. It was like a big ship, actually, wasn't it?
For me, I didn't know that, and there was so much drama leading up to what would happen, because I kind of got the sense that he wasn't still alive, just the way people talked about him, but I didn't know what was going to happen. And actually, at one point, they had the department, the officials and everyone, decided that they would actually capture him and try to reunite him with his pod, like drive him miles away. And
that never came to fruition.
And
right?
And then there was also this sort of hidden agenda that that people thought that they were actually going to sell him to Marine Park.
Gosh.
And that was in writing as well. There was offers on the table.
Really?
For sure. So when they were capturing him and trying to capture him in this pen on this one day, the drama was so high, and the First Nations actually in the area thought that Luna was an embodiment of one of their deceased elders, and so they were intensely invested in protecting Luna from being captured and just leaving him in the sound to do what he wanted and just to interact with people.
Yeah.
And so there was this kind of big showdown that got a lot of media attention. And
you talk about how everyone that connected with Luna, everyone who looked into the eyes of Luna, even yourself who only saw him on the screen, connected with him as an individual. And I want to bring up the point that that connection can be made with any single individual animal, I believe, if you make that connection and give them a chance. So that's something I think to take from this film is, one thing to take from this film is that every animal is an individual that can be respected and cherished and loved and appreciated, just like Luna was.
What I find really interesting is the statistic that you mentioned, is the fact that they said that, you know, whales that interact with people usually die a younger life. And I'm thinking that they get these statistics from whales that are in captivity and interact with people being in aquariums and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So.
I'm not sure. It is. Like, there wasn't necessarily a mandate from the movie that they were, like, anti-captivity or anything. And actually, the filmmakers of the movie ended up taking sides in the end, though, once they connected with Luna, which was really interesting. And they
wanted her
to just be free and do what she was doing. I keep saying that, too.
Well, thank you for that. We have to tie it up. Thanks for that review.
I just wanted to say quickly, though, that it was, like, incredibly, incredibly, incredibly moving.
I really want to see it now. One of the most touching films I've seen in years.
On DVD, because last night was the last night it was showing in Vancouver, but it is showing in other places. Thewhalemovie.com is where you can find out.
Okay, exactly.
Thanks.
Go ahead, you can say it. Use the F word. We say it live on the radio. Maybe you've heard. Mondays at noon, we go for an hour. We talk about culture, gender, race, class, and power. We're bringing sexy back under attack. Cause it's about time folks started taking some flack for promoting a culture where you must be a pessimist if you want to speak your mind and say something feminist. But we know it's not true. From the truth you can't run. Feminists simply have so much more fun. If the trash that you hear makes you angry or bored,
Welcome back to Animal Voices Radio Show here on Cooperative Radio 102.7 FM. This is Tara, and I'm going to be reading you some of the news from this week and last week. So last month, a new animal cruelty law went into effect in Nevada that increases the penalties for torturing or killing animals from misdemeanors to felonies. But a last-minute amendment makes the abuse cases secret from the public, nicknamed Cooney's Law after a dog named Cooney was brutally killed in a Reno hotel. The new measures has animal rights activists concerned that the limits limits rescue organizations' abilities to investigate cruelty cases and seek assistance from the public to care for abused animals. Gina Gresson from Nevada Voters for Animals tells the Reno Gazette Journal, "Not being able to talk about these cases makes it difficult for us as animal welfare advocates. The whole point of the was to protect the reporting party and not the alleged offenders." So I think that's absolutely horrible, and I feel like the laws are really being twisted by, you know, people that don't really understand, and you know, they should be talking to people like Gina about, you know, how this affects them, and it should be taken more into consideration. In other news, last week the Humane Society of the United States filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission against nearly a dozen retailers for advertising garments containing real fur as faux. Independent laboratory testing organized by HSUS reveals that at least 15 articles advertised as faux fur were actually made with the pelts of animals like coyote, raccoon, and sheep, putting retailers in direct violation of the 1951 Fur Protects Labeling Act and the 2010 Truth in Fur Labeling Act. The complaint names major retailers as falsely advertising the garments. So I think this is absolutely appalling, and it frustrates me when I'm walking down the street and I see people wearing real fur and I can tell that it's real fur, and they tell me that it's faux fur, and I'm like, no, it's not. I can tell you that it's real. If you burn it, it's going to smell like burning hair, and you can tell just by the way that it floats. And they're
I
just
used
so
to not
convinced.
Be able to tell, but now when I do come across fur in the stores, mm-hmm. I look at it, and you can definitely yeah. tell it. It looks fake and yeah. synthetic if it is, and I think it looks real, like yeah. real fur if it is. If it looks real, it is real, probably, even if it's labeled as mm-hmm. Synthetic in the stores. Or was a controversy some years back with that the Bay was had some items that were labeled non-fur mm-hmm. and they were real fur. So, yeah. you know, even if it says it's not, it could be.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So really do your due diligence when you're checking out for, you know, labeling, because it could be mislabeled. So this past Wednesday, I went to a PETA protest outside Canada Place and the Vancouver Convention Centre, where there was a BC dairy industry conference taking place. I dressed up as a cow in a cow costume, and led my fellow activists in a march up and down the street while chanting, "There's no excuse for animal abuse," and ringing
a
cowbell.
You made the news.
Yes, I did.
That's
I was
great.
In a
and
costume.
You're here to tell us with firsthand experience.
Yeah, it was really hard work. You know, those cow costumes, it was cold winter here in Vancouver, but
you didn't
in
have
those,
a fleece on underneath? You
well,
didn't...
no, I dressed up. I had my jacket and everything else on, and then you put this cow costume on, and you just get so warm and so hot. But yeah, it was lots of fun, and we handed out lots of literature. And even if we just, you know, got through to one person, it was definitely worth it. And yeah,
thank you for that.
That's the news.
You're listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM, CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
And now for our first interview, I'm going to talk to Maya Mayhem, an activist here in Vancouver. Throughout the entire five-week encampment at the Vancouver Art Gallery as part of the Occupy Together movement, the local chapter of Food Not Bombs dished up hearty meat-free meals to all at no cost. For those who don't know, Occupy Together is an international movement started around the Occupy Wall Street movement, which seeks to bring awareness to the idea that when corporations put profit over people, self-interest over justice, and oppression over equality, and when they start running our governments, that is bad news, and that needs to change. And Food Not Bombs, for those who don't know, is a charity, is not a charity, but rather an entirely volunteer-run, leaderless organization with over 1,000 chapters around the world. That shares plant-based food as a way of protesting war and poverty. Our guest today, Maya Mayhem, is a dedicated Food Not Bombs volunteer and animal activist, and was working tirelessly at the Occupy camp here in Vancouver nearly every day. She's joining us today to talk about her experiences in the makeshift kitchen and to shed light on how animal ethics and veg food outreach fit under the umbrella of the Occupy movement. Thank you so much for joining us today, Maya.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So first of all, I wonder if you can just tell us about your involvement with Occupy Vancouver. What were you up to there?
Sure. Okay, so I started off with the Food Not Bombs Committee. As soon as I heard about the Occupy movement and the fact that it was coming to Vancouver, we kind of jumped on getting Food Not Bombs involved in it. We know that there's been kitchens set up at all the Occupies around the nation. And we really wanted to make sure that the kitchen at Occupy Vancouver was free of oppression and was free of harm. So we wanted a vegan kitchen there as soon as possible. So as soon as we heard of it, we got involved.
Awesome. And can you tell us about how many people did the volunteers at the kitchen, how many people did you feed?
It's really hard to say how many actual people we fed, but as far as meals go, we were doing about 1,000 servings a day.
Oh my goodness, amazing. Yeah. And where did all this food come from?
Well, we had a huge amount of community support, which was fantastic. Normally, Food Not Bombs in Vancouver outsources food from a variety of different organizations like Discovery Organics and Quest Foods, mm-hmm. Companies that do a lot of wholesale organic shipping. And a lot of times they're left with stuff that they can't use. So instead of throwing it in the garbage, they are super generous and give it to us so we can make delicious food out of it.
And that's kind of the policy or the mandate of Food Not Bombs is redistribution of food that would go wasted.
Absolutely.
But you had a lot of just food donations from just the public who supported the movement.
We sure did, yeah. It was amazing. You know, people were coming down daily with food. We had one woman who likes to be called Mama, and she is amazing. She brought down food every single day, like a pot of soup, a pot of rice, hummus, fried bananas.
Oh, wow.
And she actually even altered her traditional Indonesian cuisine by adopting a vegan way of making it, so going out and getting vegetarian fish sauce and making sure there wasn't any meat in it, you know, so varying from how she would normally prepare it. She just adopted this veganism for us just to make sure that people were eating the vegan food, which was just amazing.
So it was mostly all vegan food that you're serving from your kitchen?
Mostly, yeah. Anything that we prepared was vegan. We did have a lot of things coming in at the very beginning that would be meat or dairy products, so we had a separate table set up for that so that it was clearly labeled, just because as Food Not Bombs, we really can't be distributing anything that has meat or dairy in it, mm-hmm. but we weren't going to stop that food from going out to the public because people were kind enough to bring it in. So, but I found that as the movement went on, more and more people were asking us questions about how to make things vegan and how to kind of, you know, end the cruelty to animals, and we're subsequently bringing in food that was vegetarian and vegan for everybody.
And that's, can you just tell us a bit about the reasoning behind, like, vegan food only from Food Not Bombs and your own ethics? Like, what in general, why is that a policy?
Absolutely. Well, Food Not Bombs really strives to end oppression to all beings. You know, if we're going to take a stand against universal suffering and if we're going to take a stand against oppression, then we need to extend that circle of compassion to everybody. It can't just be for humans alone. It needs to encompass all of the animals. Also, there's a safety aspect. You know, if we're serving food kind of out in the open, at the tent, we need people to be safe. There can't be any kind of cross-contamination with salmonella or with E. coli. And though that can happen in vegetables, it's definitely a lot less likely than would happen in, say, raw meats or eggs or dairy.
Right, that makes sense. What were some of the reactions? Like, did people sort of understand that the idea of veg food only, was there resistance to that idea? Did you have to bring that up and kind of address that concern to anyone?
There was definitely an overall gratitude for there being food on site.
Of course, yeah.
But at the beginning, there was definitely some resistance just in the fact that, different people identified their needs for themselves. And there was this perception that people needed meat. So as much as we could, whenever we had a chance, we would address the General Assembly and just kind of bring forth this notion of eating cruelty-free and standing in solidarity with non-human animals. To make sure that everybody was free of oppression.
Right.
So, and as it went, you know, we had a literature table that kind of gave people a lot more information about vegan lifestyle, and that you can really live healthily without consuming meat or animal products. And we had some people who beforehand had never really gotten into veganism or even vegetarianism, and at the end of the 5 weeks, they expressed that they had never felt better. You know, they had been eating vegan food for that long, and their bodies
were
just
good to hear.
Oh, they just felt amazing.
Good. Yeah, that's great. I'm glad to hear that there was impassioned activists kind of getting the word out there, because I know the crowd is receptive to, you know, new ideas and drawing those connections is really important. Just to bring it back to the sort of broader picture and the Occupy movement, it was part of the declaration of the occupation of New York City that they wanted to address certain facts, and animals were included in that declaration in a couple ways. I'll just read those here. They have poisoned, or corporations have poisoned the food supply through negligence and undermined the farming system through monopolization. They have profited off the torture, confinement, and cruel treatment of countless animals and actively hide these practices. Can you tell us a bit about your understanding of how unchecked capitalism and corporate greed lead to more suffering for animals?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, these industries are just so implicit in marketing that there's no animal cruelty going on. You know, they hide the truth from the general public. And because they have so much money behind them, people believe it. You know, they believe that there's humane eggs and free-range chickens and all of these atrocities that just don't exist, you know. So taking a stand, really using this Occupy movement that stands against corporate greed and against capitalism and against, you know, evil conglomerate forces, really adhering to that and bringing that to the food industry and bringing that to the way that we eat and the way that we approach other animals was really beneficial for us, you know, being able to bring forth the notion that big industry is big industry. And if they're going to lie to you about interest rates, about that kind of stuff, then they're definitely going to lie to you about how animals are treated.
Mm-hmm. And if animals are just seen
especially
as...
especially going to lie about you about that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And at the sort of bottom line, I think if they're just seen as, if animals are seen as just productive units rather than feeling individual beings, and just seen for their utility, I think that kind of gets to the heart of the matter. But
absolutely. Another point that that we were able to really reach people on was the environmental implications of non-vegan diets. You know, the Occupy movement involves a lot of fantastic environmental activists. Who dedicate their lives to the preservation of Mother Earth. But not everybody really makes the connection between animal suffering and environmental devastation. So we were able to bring those forth, to talk to people about deforestation for cattle production and about the chemicals that go into the fur and leather industries, and really just show people that you know, all forms of oppression are related.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So you talked about there was a large presence of environmental activists and advocates. I think there was less of a presence of animal advocates. That's my understanding. I wonder if you can tell us why you think that animal advocates should get more involved with the Occupy movement and with making the connections between what's happening now and standing up against corporations. Like, why should animal advocates care and get involved?
I think that as animal rights activists, we often, you know, the campaigns that we work on are so devastating and so brutal, and it takes so much of our energy that we don't often get to reach out to campaigns that involve social justice or environmental protection. But the one thing that the Occupy movement has done is it's brought together all of these amazing activists that care about each and every injustice that's going on in the world. and through this, we're able to support each other and really get on board. I find that being in a community now of activists with such broad interests has really allowed us to feel more powerful, to feel more enabled to make change. You know, instead of being 10 activists that don't really, you know exactly what they can do for their one specific goal, now there's hundreds of activists, and all we need to do is talk to one another, have a march, you know, do whatever we need to do to make a change.
A march is always good. Maya, I'm interested to know, you must have had many conversations with a diverse variety of people while you were down there who are all for or all against the human oppression, the corporate oppression as it pertains to humans. Did you have conversations with people where you engaged them with the idea of how animals all fit into this? And if so, what were their impressions? Was this something that was new to them? Were they able to open their minds, obviously, because their minds are already open and see the connections there? What was the feedback you got from people?
Actually, I found that that people were really, really receptive to it. A lot of people, like I said before, hadn't made that connection before. But as soon as we started to talk about it and started to talk about, you know, how animal rights is just as important as everything else, people really started to open their minds. And I found that, like, just being able to have that dialogue was so powerful. And it was something that we might have not been able to have had it been, you know, just approaching a stranger on the street.
Right.
But there, you know, we were all united with this common goal of standing up against, you know, the evil forces of our society. And so I really felt like, yeah, people had open minds and open hearts, and they were really willing to listen to that message. And, I mean, we had a few people go vegetarian and go vegan from this experience.
Nice. I'd like to also answer that question if I could. I know this isn't all about me or whatever, but I was actually there on October 15th for the Walk for Farm Animals, mm-hmm. which was planned months in advance of the first day rally of the occupation movement in Vancouver. It was October 15th, so we were there. I was a little bit nervous that it was the same day, same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I did actually have some really good conversations with other people there, and people did seem very receptive. One man in particular was holding a sign that said, "We don't exist just to be milked." And so I kind of called him on that. I said, "Oh, you must be vegan," or, like, "I like your sign." And
we say that to people too. "Oh, are you vegan?"
Well, and he was like, "Well, I don't understand." And I'm like, "Well, do you think cows exist to be milked, or other animals exist just for their, you know, their utility to us? So do you think they want to be our slaves?" And he was really, like, I think I really opened his mind. He's like, "Oh, I think I get it now." Like,
that's so fantastic.
Yeah.
There's so many people that I think are just on the edge. They're ready. They just haven't quite connected the dots yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I asked you, Maya, like, these people that are all at this huge movement, they've got to start connecting the dots, especially with the presence of Food Not Bombs there and your volunteerings, having that dialogue with people as to why you're there and the connection between animals and society and using them and our food and using people and corporations using us. It all
Absolutely.
Fits in together.
Yeah.
Well, strongest arguments, or not even arguments, one of the strongest conversations I've had with people is a correlation between feminism and animal rights.
Yeah.
You know, because there are a lot of fantastic feminists out there that don't actually know the ins and outs of the dairy industry. You know, they don't know that mother cows are being raped and forcibly impregnated. You know, so as soon as they find out these facts, and I find that this is kind of a way, this is where the disconnect lies, is that people don't actually know what's going on behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
So the more, and this is where Food Not Bombs is fantastic, because we come and we serve free food, and who doesn't like free food? And while we're doing that, we can have these conversations, we can give out literature, and we can educate the public about what really goes on.
Awesome. Yeah, we really appreciate the work you're doing here, and thank you so much. And I wonder, though, if people are interested in getting involved in the local Food Not Bombs chapter or, you know, in the Occupy movement, can you recommend any specifics on how people could join in?
Absolutely. Well, one, we're having a regroup, reconnect, and reconvene forum on Occupy Vancouver, so kind of like we did when the movement first started, and that's happening December 10th. I believe it's noon, it's either noon or 2 p.m. At the Woodward Atrium, and we're welcoming everybody possible, like people that have been involved in Occupy, people that have questions, people that have concerns, everybody to come down, and we're going to reestablish the committees and really, you know, get off the ground again. Food Not Bombs, you can check us out on Facebook, we're Food Not Bombs Vancouver. We welcome anybody to come in and help cook and help serve and whatever they like to do.
That's excellent. Well, thank you so much for sharing. Thanks, I hope we've inspired people. I'm definitely feeling inspired. I want to get more involved. And yeah, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And I have our upcoming events now. And to start off, Tara, I think you have an event happening tomorrow that you wanted to tell us about.
Yes, tomorrow I'm going to be at the Aboriginal Center on Hastings Street, 1607 East Hastings Street. And I'm going to be there with innovation or harmless innovations from 10 to 5 p.m. And we're going to be selling vegan dream catchers and vegan baked goods as well. So come say hi to us.
That sounds good. On Sunday, December the 4th at 11:30 a.m., volunteers are needed for leafleting at the annual Santa Claus Parade in downtown Vancouver. This is an action hosted by Liberation BC, which is a local animal activist group in Vancouver. So they will be handing out their talking turkey leaflets and spreading the message of holiday compassion for all during this very busy event in downtown Vancouver. If you would like to partake in this leafleting venture, meet at 11:30 a.m. at the City Centre Canada SkyTrain station, which is located at Granville and Georgia Street. For more information, or if you'd like to volunteer, you can contact roger@liberationbc.org. On Saturday, December the 10th at 7 p.m., a Veg Meetup Vancouver will be hosting an organic vegan holiday party. This is happening at Rooted on the Drive Cafe at 1025 Commercial Drive, Vancouver. I think it sounds great, which is why I'm going, and I would love it if you guys would join me, but you haven't responded to my email. Anyways, now I'm going to put you on the spot and tell you about this, and you can tell me if you want to go or not. It has actually changed a bit. It was going to be just an all-raw meal, and there is an option for an organic vegan cooked meal as well. This holiday party will feature a vegan dinner and yummy treats, games, music, and mingling to celebrate the holiday season. There will be lots of friendly and like-minded people there to meet, such as myself. So as I mentioned, there are two fantastic sounding dinner options for this event. You can have either a raw vegan organic meal or a cooked vegan organic meal as follows. $26 for the raw meal, which consists of a creamy broccoli soup, marinara zucchetti with flax crackers, a winter cabbage salad, a simply beet salad, and maple pear pie for dessert. Or for $19, you can have the cooked vegan meal, which sounds equally as good. That consists of a creamy green soup, a mixed green salad, and cranberry citrus dressing, spiced quinoa, ratatouille, and a spiced lentil ball, and an orange pound cake with whipped cream for dessert. In addition, there will be beverages, hot apple cider, chai tea. There will be raw treats, organic chocolate cheesecake, little truffles, a fruit platter with sweet cashew dip, and a savory vegetable platter and hummus as well. Door prizes and games, music and mingling. If you want to go to this event, go to meetup.com/vegvan. Are you guys in?
I am so busy lately.
Yeah. I've heard it all before. Okay, never mind. I'll go by myself. Here's another event I'm going to, which I've also invited you all to. Saturday, December the 17th at 6:30 p.m., there's a holiday potluck party. So another vegan food event. This one is presented by Earth Save Canada. It's happening at Kitsilano Neighborhood House at 2325 West 7th Avenue in Vancouver. So this is a solstice / Christmas / Hanukkah / Festivus celebration, whatever it is that you believe in or celebrate. And instead of an entrance fee, Earth Save is asking for a donation for the food bank instead to get in. The company's Field Roast is sponsoring the event and providing their all-natural non-soy veggie roasts as the main course. So you only need to bring either a side dish or dessert to this potluck event, and your dish should be vegan so that everyone can partake in eating it. And it can be store-bought or homemade, just enough to provide 8 people. And I like, this is what it says on the ad, it should be enough to provide 8 people a good size scoop. So to find out more and to pre-register for this event, go to meetup.com/meatlessmeetup. That's M-E-A-T-L-E-S-S meetup. I would suggest you do this ASAP, either as there are already 100 people signed up plus 30 on the waiting list, but the waiting list is expected to open. They're expected to open 40 more spots. So there are basically 10 spots free if you get on the waiting list right now. And so go on there right now. Are you guys coming? I'm very, very busy that night. Okay, I'll go to that one myself as well. If you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver. Today's feature interview is with Danielle Thompson, who is the Executive Director of the Galapagos Preservation Society, an organization based in Washington State which strives to protect the indigenous wildlife and unique ecosystem of the Galapagos Islands while promoting the welfare of dogs and cats. Danielle will be heading to the islands next month on a venture to improve the lives for the animals there, and she is here today to talk to us about that and the work that the society does. Hello, Danielle, and welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show.
Hi, Allison. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show. I first met you last year at an animal rights conference, which was when I learned about the Galapagos Preservation Society, and I was impressed at the mission of the organization, which in part works towards improving the lives of the cats and dogs on the island. Could you start by telling us more about the mandate of the organization and why and how it was started?
Sure. Well, like you said, Galapagos Preservation Society, or GPS, protects wildlife, promotes animal welfare, and conserves the biodiversity of the Galapagos Islands. And it was started by my friend, Allison Lance, who's the president of GPS. And she started it because she visited the islands with another organization over the course of many years, and she saw the decline of the wildlife there and the rise in the population of dogs and cats. So she witnessed this firsthand, and on every trip she went on, she began bringing stray dogs and cats back with her to Washington and other parts of the U.S. where she would find homes for them. So Galapagos Preservation Society is really just an expansion of her personal work, doing that for many years.
So I'm a bit curious. I know, like, Galapagos Islands are very far away. I don't know too much about them, but you're based in Washington. I presume that this society was started because there's nothing happening there. Would you say that that's why the focus is on the Galapagos Islands?
Right, exactly. Well, there are a lot of organizations that work in the Galapagos Islands, but there is no organization that, you know, has our mission. And it is very far away. It's 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador, so it's the 21st province of Ecuador in South America. And as you said, we're actually based on an island in Washington State. So, you know, it's, as it happened, the founder and president, Allison, as I said, was visiting the islands with another organization. So, and she saw the plight of the wildlife and the dogs and cats there. And while there are many organizations focused on protecting Galapagos, none do it in this way. So that's why she felt it was necessary.
Can you talk a bit about the history of the Galapagos Islands and the indigenous life there for those who don't know anything about them? It really is quite a special place. I learned today that it is named a World Heritage Site, a biosphere reserve, a whale sanctuary, and a Ramsar site.
Yeah, so, you're very right. You've done a lot of research. That's great. I can give a sort of a brief history, and I always recommend people read the book called Galapagos at the Crossroads by Carol Ann Bassett. It's a fascinating book about the history of the Galapagos. It was, I guess, discovered, quote-unquote, in the 1500s by a bishop of Panama who accidentally bumped into the islands as he was going by them.
How does one bump into an island?
right. And then in the early 1800s, pirates used the islands as a stopover, and that's actually why a lot of the non-native animals got there in the first place. Pirates would actually put goats on the islands to come back and hunt them later, so they would have a food source. And then dogs and cats that were aboard the ships actually made their way, you know, accidentally, and, you know, I'm sure on purpose, some of them to the islands from those ships. Of course, Darwin arrived in the Galapagos in 1835, and his study on those islands, you know, led to his theory on natural selection. And then in the following World War One, Europeans went to the islands fleeing Nazism, and it was two historic families of Norwegians and Germans, and they are, you know, their lineage is still on the islands today. And then in the 60s, more tourists came, and then it was, you know, annexed by Ecuador, and more native Ecuadorians began moving to the islands to support the tourism industry. So really, there's no native population on the Galapagos Islands themselves. They were uninhabited. But now, today, there's about 40,000 people living there. There's about 160,000 tourists annually, which we believe is way too many to support the island. But yeah, that's a you know, pretty brief history. But if people want to know more, definitely check out that book I mentioned, Galapagos at the Crossroads.
So what is the current situation on the islands with the dogs and cats, and why is it imperative to take action to improve conditions for them in the Galapagos? I'd like to know about the issues there, such as the stray and free-roaming dogs and cats. Why is this happening?
Sure. So there are thousands of, you know, free-owned and, you know, non-owned dogs and cats in the Galapagos, and that's mainly because there's people living there, and, you know, they have dogs and cats as pets. They also have them, you know, to control rodent populations and to hunt feral pigs, to work, you know, as guard dogs, much, you know, the same reasons we have dogs and cats in the U.S. and in Canada. But unlike the U.S. and Canada, sterilization is low to non-existent, so there are, you know, thousands of new puppies and kittens born, you know, every year, and it's a problem not only for the dogs and cats' welfare, but also for the sensitive ecosystem and native wildlife, which has all evolved without any natural predators, and so they don't have any defenses against dogs and cats who not only hunt them, but also, you know, just terrorize them. So it's not a good situation for the dogs or the cats, or for the wildlife and the ecosystem. So what we're trying to do is educate people on the importance of spay and neuter, and provide free and low-cost spay and neuter services, and also free fencing programs to improve welfare of dogs who would be on a chain or just left to roam freely. And then we also, you know, do adoptions, and try, you know, we're also trying to stop the breeding of dogs and cats, commercial breeding, because that's legal there and it's happening more and more. And then also the illegal smuggling of purebred puppies from the mainland to sell on the island.
So is it
a lot of things.
Yeah, is it actually legal to bring just regular dogs and cats to the islands? Because I think that's something that you want to...
No, it's illegal to bring any animals to the Galapagos Islands because of the threat to the native wildlife,
right,
and the ecosystem. However, we know that people have done that and are continuing to do that because, for instance, when the co-founder Allison Lance started working in the Galapagos 12 years ago, there were only, you know, mixed breed brown big-eared dogs on the islands. And today you can see every type of breed.
So
there.
There's even chihuahuas there.
Pugs, yeah, chihuahuas, huskies, pit bulls, terriers of every kind, and they're purebred dogs. So, you know, they're coming from somewhere because they didn't exist there before. So they're, you know, people are bringing them there and selling them to, you know, to make money as a side business. And now there's breeding operations that are popping up on the islands themselves. And that, unfortunately, has not been outlawed. So if, you know, people can breed dogs and sell them on the islands. And so we're trying to work to combat that.
You said that sterilization is low to non-existent on the islands. What is the problem with the lack of education on the Galapagos with regards to spaying and neutering? And can you speak on the cultural attitudes there towards getting animals fixed?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would say that a primary reason that dogs and cats have not been sterilized there is just because of a simple lack of veterinary care. There's four islands that people live on, but only two of them have veterinarians, and one of those veterinarians is one that a sister organization, Darwin Animal Doctors, which is based in New York City, has placed there. So even if people wanted to get their animals spayed and neutered, you know, there's just not anyone who could do it, really. So now that But the cultural attitudes are different than they are in the U.S. and in Canada towards sterilization. There is a hesitancy towards it because a lot of people feel that it's not as prevalent. So people don't know about it. They're afraid for their pets that it's going to, you know, cause their pets to go under, you know, trauma, pain, and suffering, and also change the pet's personality. But then also there are a lot of dogs, in particular there, that are used for hunting and for farm work. And though the hunters and farmers don't want to neuter or spay their dogs because they feel like it'll make them lazy and not want to go out and work, which we know not to be true. And it actually, you know, makes the dog more attentive to the person and, you know, what their owner wants to do with them. So that's what we're trying to educate people on, and just, you know, make it more available for free or, you know, very low cost to people. So it becomes more the norm there, where it hasn't before.
So the Galapagos Preservation Society envisions the mandatory sterilization of all cats and dogs on every island, the prohibition of breeding dogs and cats on Galapagos, as well as the strict enforcement of the law prohibiting transport of dogs and cats to the islands, which you've mentioned a bit already. Can you talk about what kind of work you have done so far and what you plan to do with regards to having all these parts of this vision materialize? And one thing you had mentioned was free services that you're providing the communities there.
Right. So so we work with volunteers there in the Galapagos, and we do, you know, several different campaigns during the year. And I, myself and Allison, the co-founder, go there at least a couple of times a year, and we do campaigns that are, you know, humane education, where we've gone and talked to hundreds of kids in four or five different schools and give a presentation on the importance of taking good care of pets and also the importance of protecting wildlife in what is their backyard, because they don't teach kids about that there in the normal curriculum, which is also something we're working on changing, making that part of just, you know, everyday curriculum, which it used to be, but because of budget cuts, it's not in there anymore. Then we also have a free fence building program where we identify people that have dogs that are either left to roam free or they keep them chained up, and we, you know, work with them to spay and neuter the animal first and then build a fence for the dog with their help and the help of other volunteers. And that's, you know, that help, you know, it's sort of a community outreach, community building program, but it also improves the life of the dog considerably. And then if the dog is, you know, was left to roam free, it will also, you know, protect wildlife because the dog will now be you know, inside of a yard. And then we also do spay and neuter campaigns, and that's the campaign that's coming up in January. We're going over with veterinarians to do free spay and neuter work. And then the organization I mentioned before, Darwin Animal Doctors, we work closely with them, and they have a clinic on Santa Cruz where they provide spay and neuter all the time, and so we support that clinic as well and work with them really closely.
So you are doing this trip in mid-January. You're going to be going to the Galapagos Islands with a team of volunteers, I understand. You mentioned the spay and neuter program. I also understand you're going to be handing out 1,000 humane education brochures to give to local children on the island and conducting just general outreach and education. Is there anything else you wanted to tell us about the trip?
No, that's all. I mean, that you pretty much summed it up. And just that we, for this trip, it's, you know, it's kind of, it's coming up really quickly now, but we always are looking for volunteer veterinarians and vet techs and other people that have, you know, animal handling experience, and lay people as well, but veterinarians are, of course, like the most needed. And if anyone listening wants to come and help out in the Galapagos, they can email me directly. My email is danielle@gpsociety.org. And, you know, we'll be arranging future trips. So, you know, we're always looking for volunteers, and the clinic that's there is always taking vet volunteers as well. And it's really helpful to get veterinarians from Canada and the U.S. to provide services and then also to teach the local vets that we work with.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of the volunteer opportunities with your organization, I'm just curious. So you need the vets. You need people to actually go out with you to assist with the outreach and education. I assume there's quite a bit of animal handling. What kind of experience, what kind of volunteers are you looking for apart from the trained vets and vet techs? Who can volunteer?
Sure. Anyone that has, you know, animal handling experience or is not, you know, afraid to, you know, interact with dogs and cats, I guess. I mean, they're not wild dogs and cats. They're, you know, they're
domesticated. Are they friendly? They're friendly, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's no feral dogs, and on the upcoming campaigns, we're not going to be dealing with feral cats, although that is a huge issue, and we do want to tackle that, but that's not on the immediate horizon. But then other than that, you know, just people that aren't afraid to work hard, to be flexible, because when you're on the ground in the Galapagos, things never go as you planned. And if you can speak Spanish, that would help a lot.
Oh, that's great. You are also looking for in-kind donations for your upcoming trip. Can you tell us what you need and how anyone listening to this can get these items to you?
Sure. This list also appears on our website, and I won't read the whole thing because it's pretty long. But basically any kind of supplies from a vet clinic we can use. I mean, really, no matter how small or insignificant they might seem to someone listening, the clinic there that we support and the one that we'll be bringing with us basically when we go in January has nothing to start with, so anything and everything can help, and we can even use expired medication that, you know, that is still good, but often vets aren't allowed to use it in the U.S. and Canada, although it's, you know, it's still safe for use. So one of the most needed things, though, because it's the most expensive to buy, is suture material, and vets and vet techs will know what that is, but it's we need 2 and 3 internal and external suture materials, and that can be sent to our headquarters in Washington, and the address is on our website, or people can email me directly for another address, or if they live in California, I could even pick it up.
Wow, pick up in California. And I want to mention, too,
depending on where.
Okay. I want to mention, too, that you are a registered charity, and, of course, as any charity does, you will take cash donations as well, and that's tax deductible.
Yeah.
Cash is always
good.
On
our website, there's a donate button. Then you can donate over the Internet with, you know, securely with credit card as well. And Yeah, in-kind donations are great, but of course, yeah, cash is always the best because we can use it for whatever we might need at the time, which might change.
Well, I wish you the best on your upcoming trip. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Danielle, to tell us about the good work of the Galapagos Preservation Society and your upcoming trip in January to help the animals there in need. For more information, please visit the Galapagos Preservation Society's website at www.gpsociety.org. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Next week on the show, for our feature interview, we will have Twyla Francois, who is the Central Region Director with the Canadian Horse Defense Coalition. She will be speaking with us about the recently introduced Bill C-322 in Canada, which hopes to put an end to horse slaughter in our country. Plus, we'll be sharing some new findings of the organization. And I'm also planning to present a segment that discusses the human rights issues of animal slaughterhouse workers, showing that animal rights and human rights really do share a strong connection. We here at the Animal Voices Show modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. You can do so by signing up for our Facebook page, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Also, please do check out our website at www.animalvoices.org, where our shows can also be downloaded from, and you can get our shows from iTunes as well. If you appreciate the work that we do here every week at Animal Voices to bring you original quality programming on the topics of current animal issues and the vegan lifestyle, please do show us your support by making a donation to Animal Voices at Co-op Radio, because you really do rely on your donations to keep the show on the air. To make a donation of $5, $10, $20, or whatever you can afford, simply go to cooperadio.org and click on Donate Now. And remember to indicate on your donations that it donation that it's going towards Animal Voices. If you're in Canada, we are a registered charity and your donations are tax deductible. Every little bit helps, so we thank you for your assistance. We are going to be leaving you now with the Animal Song by Savage Garden. Please tune in again next week. Thanks for listening, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Superstars and cannonballs are running through your head. A television freak show, cops and robbers everywhere. Subway makes me nervous, people pushing me too far. I got to break away, so take my hand now, cause I want to live. Animals and children tell the truth, they never lie. Which one is more human? There's a thought, now you decide. Compassion in the jungle, compassion in your hands, yeah. Would you like to make a run for it? Would you like to take my hand? Cannonballs are running through your head. Tell
television freak show, cops and robbers everywhere. Animals and children tell a truth they never lie. Which one is more human? There's a thought, now you decide. Compassion in the jungle, compassion in your head.